Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 11. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your support. We've been doing these for almost a year now, and I think it's safe to say they've been a success. I want to thank you all for participating. I've been really impressed by the quality of the questions. If I haven't gotten to yours, I'm sorry, there simply isn't time to get to every one. And to be honest, some of them are actually too good, and not something I could do justice in this short, informal format. Anyway, I thought we'd start this installment by going a little deeper into one of our digressions from the last episode. I mentioned the late 19th, early 20th century German military theorist, Baron Kolmar von der Goltz. He wrote a book about the events we've been discussing, called Jena to Eylau, The Disgrace and Redemption of the Old Prussian Army. Goltz is a very interesting character. To be honest, he is a bit of a villain. A lot of his work is devoted to glorifying the concept of total war, which he saw not as a painful necessity, but as an actual social good. He's not unusual in this. A lot of his peers felt the same way, especially in Germany, and you can see why. In the mid-19th century, mobilization for war had helped unify the country and build the state, and those wars had been pretty painless. Still, this cavalier attitude towards total war among the European elite is part of the reason why so much of the world spiraled into suffering and death in the early 20th century. Obviously, we can't single out Goltz as the cause of all this tragedy. There were much more powerful forces at work here than any single individual. But in light of what happened between 1914 and 1945, a lot of his work seems very misguided, maybe even foolhardy. Still, he had a very interesting career. He is often known as Goltz Pasha because he spent much of his career in the Ottoman Empire and earned the title of Pasha. As some of you may know, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Germany and the Ottoman Empire were allies, and for geopolitical reasons, the Germans were very interested in expanding their influence in this region. Goltz was sent over as a military advisor at the invitation of the Ottoman Sultan. In fact, the Germans were eager to get rid of him because some of his ideas were unpopular with the top brass. As you could probably guess from that title of Pasha, he was warmly welcomed by the Ottomans. From what I understand, no other single person had a greater influence on the Ottoman military in the period just before the First World War. He helped lead an ambitious military reform and modernization program, and mentored an entire generation of young Ottoman officers, who practically worshipped him. By the time the war broke out in 1914, Goltz Pasha was 71 years old and retired, but the Ottoman government was able to coax him back into uniform, and he actually led Ottoman armies during the war, with the rank of field marshal. Some of you, particularly British, Indian, or Pakistani listeners, may have heard of the Siege of Kut El Amara, one of the worst defeats in the history of the British Indian Army. Goltz was in overall command of the victorious Ottoman forces. I've probably made Goltz sound like a pretty nasty character, and in a certain sense, he was. But it's also worth mentioning that he was also one of the only high-ranking Ottoman officials to come out against the forced deportations of Armenians during the Armenian Genocide. His role in the genocide is controversial. Some argue he could have done more, and may have actually been complicit in some of the early stages of the tragedy. But he did threaten to resign at one point unless the deportations were stopped, which is pretty remarkable for a field marshal in the middle of a world war, especially given that some of the architects of the genocide were his own former protégés. It is a testament to Goltz's influence that he was actually successful. The deportations did stop, although sadly only in areas where Goltz's army was operating, and only temporarily. So, an interesting and complicated figure, but his life and career were far outside the scope of our show, which is why I didn't talk more about him in the episode. Anyway, we got a lot of great questions, so let's get to them. First, Adam Morris asked, was there an overt anti-war movement in France during this time, especially when considering the brutal nature of the War of the Fourth Coalition on the front? If so, how was this received? It is a bit anachronistic to talk about an anti-war movement in the modern sense. mass politics as we know them didn't really emerge until much later in the 19th century. By our standards, the vast majority of people in France were politically disengaged. There was no real mass media to speak of, and the types of organizational concepts needed to build and maintain a national movement were much rarer, especially outside the elite. Obviously, the French Revolution had given people a taste of the power of mass politics, but there had only been a brief window of a few years in which average people were really influential in the political process, and that state of affairs had come about spontaneously due to particular social, political, and economic conditions. No one had set out to build the sans-culottes of Paris into an active, radical political constituency. They had more or less organically woken up to their own power. We saw in past episodes how, in the years after the fall of the Jacobins, many people on the far left of the French political spectrum had tried to recreate the power of the so-called mob, but none of them had any success. With that said, there was certainly anti-war sentiment in France. It was just not organized into any kind of cohesive political movement. We will be talking more about this in future episodes. Next, Graham Swiddenbank asked, "Is there any particular event you've covered in the show that you wish you could have witnessed as a fly on the wall, a battle or treaty negotiation, maybe a particularly interesting interaction between two big personalities?" I'm not sure I would enjoy witnessing a Napoleonic battle firsthand. With all the chaos and smoke, I'm not sure a layman would be able to tell what was going on, and of course, you'd see a lot of misery and gore, and your life would probably be in danger. It might be interesting just to stay near Napoleon and see how he worked during a major engagement, but probably not worth the risk of taking a cannonball to the chest. As far as negotiations go, two spring to mind. First, you might remember from one of our very early episodes a scene in which Joseph and Napoleon visited Pasquale Paoli to ask for his endorsement, or at least permission, for Joseph to run for office. At the time, Paoli's headquarters was in an abandoned monastery out in the Corsican countryside. This must have been a very dramatic setting, maybe closer to visiting a bandit encampment than the headquarters of a senior political leader. As we know, Paoli crafted his public image very carefully, so I'm sure he arranged the scene to make an impression on visitors. But not only would this be a chance to see the wily old general in all his glory, you would be able to see him interact with the Bonapartes before their terrible falling out. This was a period in which their relationship was still relatively warm. It seems Paoli was annoyed by the brash young Jacobins, but he was still cordial with them. He even gave Joseph a little souvenir, a playing card that he allegedly used as a secret calling card during his days as a resistance fighter against the Genoese. Although I'm guessing this was just a tall tale. I imagine he had a whole stack of these old playing cards behind his desk to give out to visitors with a good story. I would be very curious to see how the young Bonaparte brothers interacted with their idol. My guess would be that he treated them with a lot more contempt than they realized. The other event that springs to mind is the negotiations between Joseph Bonaparte and Lord Charles Cornwallis that ultimately led to the Treaty of Amiens. We know from both men's accounts that they worked out a lot of the most contentious issues one-on-one in a series of after-dinner brandy and cigar sessions that sometimes lasted well into the night. For starters, it would probably be a lot of fun. Joseph and Cornwallis quickly struck up a real friendship. They were both famously gregarious and good conversationalists. They had seen an awful lot, and they knew an awful lot. With a convivial atmosphere and the brandy flowing, who knows what they might reveal. But I also think these late-night chats might give us a tantalizing glimpse of what could have been. We know that Joseph and Cornwallis were often forced to walk back the progress they had made in their discussions by directives from their respective governments, particularly from Napoleon. The result was a fragile peace that neither side really had much incentive to honor, and predictably, it only took about a year to fall apart. I suspect that during these nightly brandy and cigar sessions, a much more comprehensive treaty was under discussion, something that would have actually settled many of the outstanding issues between Britain and France, rather than temporarily putting them aside. Had France and Britain actually gone down this path and managed to create a durable peace, the Napoleonic Wars would have played out very differently. They might not have happened at all. Perhaps history would remember Napoleon Bonaparte as a great peacemaker. Remember, that was his reputation for a brief period after the Treaty of Amiens. I would love to see how close we came to taking that other path. Next, Adam H. asked, what are some other eras of history you find fascinating aside from the French Revolution? I don't know how it is for the rest of you, but I've gone through many phases in my life as a history fan. Sometimes these phases are quite short and can be satisfied with an hour on Wikipedia, and sometimes they last for years and involve all kinds of books and articles and films. The earliest of my history obsessions was actually Native American history. When I was a child, I could tell you the names of every major tribe in the West, what their civilization had been like before European contact, who their great leaders were, and of course, the details of their struggles with white settlers and the U.S. government to hold on to their land. I went through a long phase where I was really into the American Civil War, which I think is true of almost every American who's interested in history. Eventually, that broadened and led me to the Reconstruction era, which I think is actually in some ways more interesting than the war itself, because the political and social outcomes of the war were still contested well after the end of the fighting, and in some ways, the outcome of the war wasn't really decided until about a decade later. Like most people who are interested in military history, I've also gone through periods of interest in the two world wars. That led me to the Russian Revolution, which in turn led me to the interwar period, which I think similarly to Reconstruction in the US is sometimes unfairly ignored. There's now a school of historians who argue we should look at this period holistically, from 1914 to 1945, as one cohesive series of events, which would include things like the Russian Revolution and subsequent Civil War, the Spanish Civil War, the Great Depression and its consequences, the various abortive communist revolutions in Europe that occurred during this period, and the rise of fascism. And I'm increasingly convinced that's the right perspective. So those are the big topics that come immediately to mind, but I've gone through at least a passing phase for almost every era of history. I can't say I've researched them all thoroughly, not even close, but I never really know where my curiosity will take me. Next, Alistair Forrest asked, if Napoleon was doing this show about himself, do you think there is anything that he would particularly focus on that you think is unimportant, or vice versa? Napoleon always said that the legacy of his domestic reforms would be more important and longer-lasting than the memory of his battlefield victories. So, he would probably tell me to wrap up the stories of his campaigns quicker, so we can focus on things like education reform or the development of the central bank. That is probably a fair criticism from a certain perspective. These comparatively dry aspects of Napoleon's career have a bigger impact on the way we live today than any of his battles. But from a storytelling perspective, it would be a challenge, to say the least. He would also probably object to the amount of time we spent covering Haiti, but if he didn't want me to cover it, he shouldn't have sent 40,000 men and an armada of ships to put the country in chains. Indirect asked, every time you talk about communications between armies, I wonder what I have to imagine it looks like in practice. With so many messengers running around between commanders, did it happen often that messengers got lost or wounded on their way, and the message never got to the addressee? What is the speed at which a message could be relayed between two commanders, and how often did they communicate with each other on campaign? Well, you're right that communications between armies and subunits of armies were a huge challenge in this era. Basically, all messages were carried by dispatch riders, a lone cavalryman on a fast horse. I'll talk a little about how the system was organized in the French army. Dispatch riders were referred to as orderlies, and they were drawn from the light cavalry regiments, which makes sense given the skill set of the light cavalry. These units had to send away small numbers of men to the various headquarters above them. These assignments were temporary, but they sometimes led to friction between the regimental commanders and their superiors. The commanders didn't like sending away good men, especially if the enemy was nearby. The troopers sent to headquarters didn't seem to like these assignments either, and apparently they sometimes left early to go back to their regiments. The light cavalry units were also required to set up so-called correspondence posts at intervals of 8 miles or 12.8 kilometers between the various units of the Grande Armée to ensure open lines of communication. This enabled a galloping messenger to change horses before his mount got completely exhausted, and prevented him from getting too lost. Even if he didn't know where he was going, in theory, he only had to navigate the relatively short distances between the correspondence posts until he reached his destination. Still, in case of unforeseen difficulties, it was standard practice to send two copies of every message, typically along different routes. For a particularly important message, three or even more copies might be sent. At maximum speed, a dispatch rider could cover about 10 miles or 12 kilometers an hour, although this pace would quickly tire a horse and was only possible in ideal weather and terrain. In practice, 5 miles an hour or 6 kilometers an hour was considered an acceptable pace, unless it was an urgent message and the rider was specifically instructed to go as fast as possible. If dispatch rider was intercepted by the enemy and was in danger of being captured or killed, it was his duty to destroy any correspondence he was carrying. The great light cavalry general Antoine Fortuné de Brock wrote a whole book full of instructions and advice for light cavalry troops, and he suggested dispatch riders carry their messages either tucked into a glove, where they could be quickly eaten, or in the barrel of a loaded pistol. Simply pull the trigger and any paper inside would be instantly destroyed by the gunpowder charge. On campaign, the various parts of the Grande Armée were in almost constant contact. In fact, this is what took up a lot of Napoleon's time when he was in the field, reading reports and messages from his subordinates and drafting responses as needed. This meant that, generally speaking, if a message did not reach its destination, this would be discovered relatively quickly. Even after the invention of the telegraph, dispatch riders remained a common feature of every professional army well into the 20th century, although with the invention of the internal combustion engine, they traded in their horses for motorcycles. And interestingly, there is some discussion of bringing them back. As electronic warfare has become increasingly sophisticated, the reliability of a hand-delivered message might make dispatch riders useful again. One last thing, a lot of this came from the book Swords Around a Throne by John Elting, which I highly recommend if you're interested in this sort of thing. Next, Quentin Boothman asked, "Something I've been wondering about is how well Napoleonic armies could understand each other. How multilingual was Napoleonic Europe? Would many soldiers on both sides of a battle often understand each other? How was communication established between people in occupied cities and the occupiers? How great was Napoleon's command of Italian, German, or English?" This is a somewhat broad question, so I'll mostly talk about the educated classes. Officers, senior civil servants, diplomats, and noblemen of this period almost all had at least some degree of advanced education, which almost always included a foreign language, and they were the ones carrying on most of the correspondence. First of all, it's important to understand that the old European nobility were very international, and generally the higher you went up the ladder, the more true that was. For example, the executed King of France, Louis XVI, had an Austrian wife, a German mother, a Polish grandfather, a German grandmother, and a Polish grandmother. Many in the upper rungs of the aristocracy had no real native language. They were often raised speaking several languages from birth. However, that was only really true of the very upper crust, mostly monarchs and their families. Most of the European aristocracy, and almost all of the educated bourgeoisie, did have clear native languages. They learned second, third, or fourth languages in school or from private tutors. French was understood by a huge proportion of the European elite. Even before the Revolution and the rise of Napoleon, the French language had a similar status in Europe to that of the English language around the world today. It was sort of a default second language for the whole continent, even in areas very far outside of France's zone of influence. Knowledge of French was useful for practical reasons, but it was also a status symbol, Those of you who are familiar with the book War and Peace, or any of its adaptations, might have noticed the preponderance of French names for the aristocratic Russian characters, Pierre and Paul, rather than Pyotr and Pavel. This really was a common affectation in this era. Ironically, the status of French as the de facto second language of Europe meant that France's enemies sometimes conducted their business in French. For instance, the correspondence between the German General Bennigsen and his superior, Emperor Alexander of Russia, was all in French. So when you hear about Napoleon's officers or officials interacting with foreigners, they were often able to do so in their own language, because it was so widely spoken around Europe. As for the French, German and English were standard parts of the curriculum in French military academies, so a large proportion of French officers had at least some knowledge of these languages. There were also large communities of foreign language speakers within France, and officers who came from these communities, or had grown up near them, often spoke these languages fluently. For instance, Marshal Massena had spoken Italian since childhood, having come from the city of Nice, which in this era was primarily Italian-speaking. Similarly, Marshal Ney spoke fluent German. He came from a Francophone family, but had German roots, and grew up in the primarily German-speaking settlement of Saarlouis. You could find similar cases in other large multi-ethnic empires. Habsburg officers from the Austrian Netherlands tended to speak French and/or Dutch, and we've already discussed the large number of Baltic Germans in the Russian officer corps, all of whom spoke fluent German, obviously. And, as we've discussed in past episodes, it was quite common for 18th century armies to recruit foreign officers. This practice was becoming less common by the Napoleonic era, but there were still large numbers of officers from diverse backgrounds within every military. So, wherever you went in Europe, if you had a large number of educated officers with you, it was pretty likely that someone would be able to have at least a basic conversation with someone, although depending on where you were, it might be in neither person's native language. If all else failed, Latin had still not totally lost its cachet among the educated classes, and was usually at least somewhat understood by Catholic priests, although it was very rarely used as a spoken language, only for reading the classics and conducting Catholic liturgy, so this could be awkward. As for the common soldiers, their general level of education was quite bad, so they would have been unlikely to get any formal training in another language. However, Europe had a lot of linguistic diversity at this time, and depending on where they were from and what their life had been like before joining the army, they might have picked up another language or dialect through exposure. A lot of them only had a very rudimentary grasp on their own army's language. Without universal public education, European countries of this era were a patchwork of local dialects. This was especially true for the Habsburg forces, which were recruited from across a very diverse empire. As for Napoleon himself, as you might remember from past episodes, his native language was Corsican, which is a dialect of Italian. In this era, Corsican was an almost purely spoken language, so most of the books Napoleon read as a youth were in standard Italian. However, he himself admitted that his Italian was imperfect, and native Italian speakers who heard him use the language could instantly tell that it was inflected with his regional dialect. You can sometimes find people who claim he spoke French poorly. I don't really think that's true. He did speak with an accent, and sometimes misspelled words in ways that betrayed his Corsican origins. But he doesn't seem to have struggled at all with fluency, and for almost his entire life, he used French far more than Corsican. So I think it's fair to say he spoke perfect, if slightly idiosyncratic, French. He learned Latin in school and read books in the language, so it seems he had a good grasp of that as well. Although, as I mentioned earlier, Latin was rarely used as a conversational language in this period, so he probably did not have much practice actually speaking it. We know he studied English and German in school. But this seems not to have made much of an impression on him, because when he made more serious attempts to learn these languages later in life, he had to start at a very basic level. So it's probably fair to say he had some exposure to English and German, but didn't really speak either. Interestingly, learning English was one of Napoleon's main preoccupations during his exile on St. Helena at the end of his life, in large part because there were far more books in English on the island than there were in French. One of his companions described his studies this way, quote, "Despite the fact that he grasped extraordinarily easily the theory of the language, the emperor had few gifts when it came to learning the mechanics of the tongue. He had an extraordinary intelligence, but a very bad memory." End quote. Next, Sawyer asked, "In your research for this podcast, how often, if ever, do you find non-English or non-French sources that you were unable to use due to the language barrier? Do you feel like it limits the narrative of the show?" I am very rarely short on material. There is an absolutely incredible amount of literature on the Napoleonic Wars available in English. Usually my problem is wading through it all and deciding where to focus my attention, not finding enough things to read. With that said, I do sometimes feel limited. I miss out on a lot in French. I speak the language and have read things in French for the show in the past, but to be honest, my level of proficiency is so low that it's simply not a very good use of my time to struggle through anything more than a few pages in French. Something that I might spend an hour speed reading in English takes me all day in French. I do wish I spoke German. Apparently there is a lot of really good material from the former Habsburg military archives that is only available in German, including things like official reports from the Habsburg commanders who fought against Napoleon, and first-hand accounts of battles and campaigns. I talked about this a bit in the episodes after Jena and Auerstedt, but the months I spent working on those episodes were probably the period where I most wished I spoke German. Those battles really made an impact on the German psyche, and turned out to be a major turning point in German history. So, as you might expect, there is far more written about them in German than any other language. That's all for now. I'm sorry we couldn't get to more questions. There were a lot of really good ones this time around, but I have to draw the line somewhere if I'm going to get a start on the next episode in the narrative. As always, thank you for your support, and I'll be back to you in a few weeks with The Battle of Friedland.